gafgreek.com.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 24 days into the month of February. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You're tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's episode, an episode of the Alberta Advantage podcast titled Expand Medicare to Include Dental Care. All that plus your weekly music picks right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @avalancheckut.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends are prohibited, and travel between regions should be avoided. In red zones, it's also forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the specific measures addressing the situation. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Wasting by the wayside. Fearful now the world's gone. This is not a love song. These aren't tears of mine.
I'm tired of the taste. Faint heart in the cold. Spent nights within. Felt silence. I'm tired of the days. Left alone.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to Don't Cry by Mormor. Up next is an episode of the Alberta Advantage podcast titled Expand Medicare to Include Dental Care. That's up now.
Makes no difference where I go, you're the best hometown.
The Alberta Advantage is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Check out our partner shows at harbingermedianetwork.com. This independent, listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/albertaadvantage.
Calgary, you know we love you.
Hello and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I am your host, Kate Jacobson, and joining Team Advantage today are Karen.
Hello.
Patrick.
Hello.
And special guests, Brandon Doucette, dentist and member of the Coalition for Dental Care, and Thomas Lang, health economist and research coordinator at the University of Calgary School of Public Policy. Brandon and Thomas, thank you for joining us here on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
So Canadians are, in general, very proud of our Medicare program. And despite strenuous efforts over the decades to privatize portions of it by some governments, it does remain a very important part of Canadian society. But it also has some quite curious limitations. If you break pretty much any bone in your body, you can go to a hospital and have it taken care of through our public Medicare system. But the bones in your mouth are currently very special exceptions to this rule. Mouth bones, or teeth, as we more commonly refer to them, are not included in Canada's Medicare coverage, unless, of course, something goes so horribly wrong with your teeth that it starts to severely impact other aspects of your health in other parts of your body. My understanding is that most people in Canada access dental care primarily through work-related insurance. How do those without work-related coverage access dental care in this country?
That's a great question. So as you mentioned, dental care was not included in our universal healthcare system. So people do primarily rely on work-related dental insurance in order to access care. And for people who don't have work-related dental insurance, they have to pay for these services either out of pocket or if they're lucky enough to be eligible for a targeted government program, which are very few and far between. So if we actually break down dental spending in Canada, what we find is that 95% of that spending goes to either work-related insurance or out-of-pocket payments. So the overwhelming majority is in the private sector, and only a meager 5% is on government programs. This is an even lower percentage of government dental spending than even the Americans.
The Canadian Community Health Survey has pointed out that about 60-ish percent Canadians have some kind of insurance plan for dental. Most of that is, as you said, employer-based, and that's about 60% for those that have it. And then the rest is either they purchase their own plan, like as a home family unit, or they do not have insurance.
As you're probably aware, our economy continues to basically shed full-time jobs with benefits and then replace those jobs with part-time and precarious gig work. What do these changes in the labor market mean for working people and how working people might access dental care?
So this results in more Canadians not having dental insurance tied to their labor because their work doesn't provide benefits like dental insurance. So this is a trend that we've been seeing for many years now. So when we talk about, for example, over 1 in 3 Canadians lack dental insurance and 1 in 5 Canadians avoid the dentists each year because of financial constraints, these are numbers that are actually rising because of these changes in the nature of work, because of younger people working in the gig economy more, but also because there's large numbers of older people who are retiring and losing their work-related benefits as well.
What happens then when people lose their dental coverage? I mean, people without coverage are still going to have, fillings that they need done, dental pain. Where do they go, to get help when they need dental care? Like what tends to happen, especially, for people who really can't afford the out-of-pocket costs?
So what happens a lot of the time when people have no dental insurance is they have to scrounge up the money. There's very limited public programs to cover people who don't have dental insurance. And oftentimes, even people who have those are covered under those programs, they struggle to find a dentist who will accept the low fees paid out by those programs. times, or they're billed the extra amount, you know, because the program pays out a low amount, they're billed the extra amount that the dentist would normally charge, which kind of precludes these people from accessing dental care. So what happens for a lot of these people is they need to ration funds. They need to put money towards pain and infection and neglect small problems. So they don't go in for cleanings because they need to focus money on extractions. They don't get small cavities filled because they need to focus on pain and infection. But what happens when this, because this is the case, those small problems grow and become larger. So part of the pain, you know, this results in a lot of pain and suffering from the population and also lowering the quality of life for people.
Yeah. And if you suddenly become unemployed, you need to prove to the government that you are eligible for these programs. And so you need to prove that you have become impoverished, because these programs are typically only geared to those who can receive social assistance and other welfare supports. And the problem is that that requires your notice of assessment from the previous tax cycle more often than not. It's not enough to just simply say, I'm now on EI, so can I go on this benefit? There's actually quite a bit of red tape and navigating of the system you have to.
Yeah, similar to that, teeth that appear shiny, bright, and white are often a kind of class marker that can be useful for things like networking and getting a job in the right circles. What consequences does the unequal distribution of dental care in our country have for social mobility and people's ability to pursue new opportunities?
Well, I think that's a great point that you just made, because I think many people can kind of, they can sympathize with the idea of if you have visible decay or missing front teeth, it would be very difficult to find a good paying job because of that social aspect. And that really kind of locks people in that cycle of poverty, because it's so hard to break out of that cycle. And as we've mentioned, those problems only compound and get worse. So it's kind of a really devastating cycle from the purely economic standpoint. There's also many other health-related aspects as well, because you could imagine how difficult it is to sleep when you have a toothache. There's also many general health conditions that actually are either caused or worsened by poor oral health. So I have a list of them here, and I think it's really kind of telling. So there's diseases like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, having a low birth weight infant, aspiration pneumonia, erectile dysfunction, osteoporosis, metabolic syndrome, and stroke. So, you know, people who can't afford dental care, they are kind of, they're destined to have those consequences because they can't afford care.
Because dental care is so difficult to obtain for so many people, there's basically an incentive to only do dental work that is absolutely necessary, or to wait until things are too bad or too painful to ignore, like you mentioned. This flies in the face of basically what we know about effective medicine, namely that preventative and early care results in better outcomes for people's health. This was a point that was really brought up a lot in the lead up to the implementation of Medicare. Could you outline a bit some of the consequences of this bare minimum when necessary approach to dental care?
So some of the consequences to this bare minimum approach is that people have to live with chronic dental pain. They have to live with missing front teeth and visible decay for many years until it becomes too painful to handle. So there's many kind of social and economic consequences. That's to the individual, but there's also costs towards society as a whole. So when people have poor oral health, as we've already mentioned, they can have poor overall health as well. So there's the costs associated to our overall healthcare system there. There's also kind of, it's harder to find a good paying job when you're missing front teeth. So there's potential for added cost to social programs as well. And there's also elements of what do you do when you can't afford dental pain? And what a lot of people end up doing is going to the doctor's office or emergency departments for dental pain, which they only end up receiving an antibiotic and pain medication, which is really just a band-aid solution that leaves them still needing to see a dentist to either have the tooth removed or to have a root canal done. And this is a really big problem. So if we look at a study done in 2014 in Ontario, they found that doctors' offices were visited 220,000 times and emergency departments 67,000 times by patients seeking treatment for dental pain. So those are huge numbers, and it results in a minimum spending of $38 million per year. And this is a very kind of downstream approach that results from our private dental care system. So this money is not well spent. And in a more sensible world, I think that that money should be going directly towards dental care.
And we should recognize that, you know, from an economic perspective, this is all waste that we as a society bear and pay in our taxes, sending people to emergency departments for issues that the ED can't treat, sending them back with, more often than not, it's just you're written a pain prescription. And if that prescription becomes covered by the public system or whatever, that's more wasteful resources that we're allocating to something that doesn't treat the root cause of the issue, if you'll pardon the pun.
You know, thinking historically here, when Medicare was implemented in Saskatchewan in 1962, prior to that happening, prior to it being adopted on a national scale, we saw the medical establishment go into like open revolt against the government that wanted to bring in these progressive reforms. So Saskatchewan's doctors opposed Tommy Douglas's CCF government in the preceding election. And then in 1962, they waged a very nasty campaign against Medicare, which included doctors going on strike. So what's your sense of the opposition among dentists to including universal dental care under Medicare? And do you think we would see dentists go on strike or do other sorts of things to oppose such a move?
I think that's a great question. I do think that from my experience, there's been a lot of mixed results from dentists. Some are very supportive. Some, to be honest, really don't see this as their problem. They come from a socioeconomic class where they don't struggle accessing dental care. And they, you know, some people just care about their bottom line. So they will see this in the same way that physicians saw the implementation of Medicare. But I think that this is something that our group with the Coalition for Dental Care, where we are working with a lot of other healthcare providers, researchers, and the public and the dental community, who are interested in this subject to try to raise the profile of an issue like this to try to overcome those barriers. Because I do think from the kind of the organized dentistry, there will be opposition, as there was opposition to kind of bold public programs in the past. Keeping in mind that when the implementation of Medicare was happening, there was kind of musing and about including dental care in our universal healthcare system. And, you know, there was excuses made by the dental community as to why that couldn't happen. And many of those excuses, in my opinion, were nonsense. They were not good reasons as to why dental care shouldn't be included in our universal healthcare system. But because physicians were kind of in the crosshairs as far as that battle for Medicare, dentistry kind of, they were able to stay out of those crosshairs, and we're still living with the consequences of that today.
I think Brandon alluded to this from an earlier question, that one of the issues with when you have public insurance and the existing smattering of plans that are out there is that these plans don't compensate the dentists to the full extent, say, as they would be compensated on the private market. And I think that this is creating a sense of skepticism in the dental community about government's commitment and role that they would, you know, that they would play in providing dental care if it was expanded. There was a survey that was done out of University of Toronto in 2009, I want to say, and looked at dentists' opinions on public insurance and public involvement in dentistry. And that's kind of the sense that they gathered. There seemed to be a skepticism out there. We also saw that about 33% of dentists in Canada made the decision to reduce the number of public insurance patients they had in their practice, which frankly to me is insulting and abhorrent, but it is a business decision. because if they aren't reimbursing you, you know, this at the rate that you need, and you have other patients coming to you, and that takes up your time, but they're willing to pay you more. Well, that homo economicus, the rational actor, obviously, you're going to choose the one that will pay more. That's the free market structure we have in dentistry, and frankly, that's what we don't like in Medicare. But I think that once if government can show that it takes dental care seriously, go enter into like real negotiations with dentists about what kind of fee schedules they'd reimburse at and at fair rates, we might see that improve. Because look at today, look at what we're having happen in Alberta when the UCP put out policy 11, which suggested moving healthcare into sort of a two-tiered state. The biggest uproar came from a lot of physicians working in the public system. So you see that sort of switch politically on sides. So I think it'll be a rough road to implementation, but once dentists see that government takes this seriously, that government does in fact take it seriously, I think we'll be well on our way.
I think something to add to what you're saying as well, Tom, is that there's the dental community's opposition, but we also have to keep in mind that there's many other financial interests at play here, whether that be private insurance companies who don't want to lose any profits. There's also, there's a trend in dentistry of corporate dentistry. So, big financial investment firms buying up a bunch of dental practices and using that as a profit generating thing to generate profits. And there's many other industries as far as dental equipments and supplies, which under a universal system, we could buy them in bulk and lower supply costs significantly. So there's a lot of other financial interests as well that we're going to face opposition from. But it's important that we stress that this opposition is something that is directly in conflict with public interest, because we can lower the cost of dental care in some ways without lowering quality.
So Brendan, you've advocated for breaking up the monopoly on dental care that dentists have in Canada by making dental therapists mainstream in Canada. Can you explain what a dental therapist is and how their duties might be different from the dental experts that we're mostly familiar with, hygienists and dentists?
Sure. So dental therapists are basically mid-level dental providers that can perform simple procedures like fillings, simple extractions, cleanings, basic procedures at a fraction of a cost of what a dentist would charge. This is a very similar relationship between a physician and a nurse practitioner. So say a nurse practitioner isn't going to be doing major surgery, but they could be placing stitches at a fraction of a cost of what a dentist can do. And when we're looking at this on a system-wide basis, we can really lower costs by utilizing these mid-level providers, especially in dentistry, because a lot of the procedures, say like fillings, are just routine things that using these mid-level providers, we can save a lot of money. This is something that we actually had a public dental plan in Saskatchewan in the 1970s and 80s that used these dental therapists in school-based dental clinics, and it was wildly successful. So the mid-level providers worked in schools. It brought dental providers to communities that before didn't have any dental provider nearby. So a lot of people before the program would have had to drive an hour and a half, 2 hours to the nearest dentist. You can imagine how difficult that is for families to take time off work and everything like that. So these school-based clinics were very accessible, and the salaried dental therapists were integral to making these procedures accessible and also affordable. So taxpayers didn't have to pay out an arm and leg because they weren't paying, for example, $250 for a filling. Because they used these mid-level providers on a salaried basis, the cost per unit of delivery for services was significantly less. Over the time of this program, children needed on average half as many fillings and extractions as they did before the program. So you can even see over the length of the program how much healthier children were getting because of the focus on prevention and early treatment. I think as well, these mid-level providers, if we're looking in the 21st century, there's a huge area in which we can use them. And I don't think they should be confined just to the school setting. The first step we'd need is to actually have a new dental therapy training program in Canada. The Saskatchewan program was privatized in the 1980s, and later in the, I think it was 2009, the last dental therapy training program was closed. So it's a field that is decreasing in size in Canada unless we open a new program. But if we do open a new program for dental therapy, the options are very exciting in my mind. So we could have dental therapists working in community-based clinics and primary health centers, as well as places like schools that I've mentioned, but also other places like long-term care facilities, prisons, and many other areas, because the traditional private practice model has left many communities without dental providers, particularly rural and indigenous communities. And the public ownership of dental clinics and hiring of dental therapists to work in them is really a very effective way to make sure that these communities have not only have dental insurance, but actually have a dental provider nearby to provide services to them.
Hey folks, we're interrupting you mid-episode to promote another podcast. Now, we wouldn't do this for just any other podcast, but if you like the Alberta Advantage, you should check out the new season of Commons, a documentary podcast from Canada Land. Host Archie Mann takes you right into this country's dark underbelly, uncovering stories of crime, corruption, and all manner of misdeeds. This season, Commons brings you stories about the police. They'll examine the power that Canadian cops wield and investigate the lengths they're willing to go to hold on to it. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast app. And honestly, I do have to say, their past seasons have been fantastic as well. They examine Canada's fossil fuel industry in their season called Crude, and then examine some of Canada's wealthiest and most powerful families in their season Dynasties. And we now return to our regularly scheduled programming. Getting to maybe one of the more contentious issues, or at least one of the questions that I think a lot of Canadians will have when we talk about including dental care in our public Medicare system, is who would pay for expanding dental care? And how could such a program be funded? It would obviously mean much more people receiving care, so more dental work would be done, and there certainly would be, you know, a range of health and economic benefits that would occur as a result. But I'm wondering how you would recommend an expanded dental care program be financed, and are there any proposals without co-pays or premiums?
So this is something that I did research on recently and published two papers with the School of Public Policy, which are available on their website, policyschool.ca. You can download them for free. The two papers I did was I was trying to figure out exactly what you asked, like, you know, what could a publicly financed universal dental care look like? And then how much would it actually cost? Because to date, we've had, you know, whispers of this, you know, even as Brandon mentioned, going as far back to the birth of Medicare, but really no cost estimate, and policymakers across the country need that. So we'll start with the first side of the equation, which is cost, and the second side is obviously paying for the cost revenue. I looked at 14 different treatment categories of dentistry, which span all the way from providing, you know, like scaling, preventative, and recall exams, things like that, x-rays, all the way up to, you know, root canals, dentures, and even some of the orthodontic work. And the cost that comes back through our econometric model, which I'll save listeners the painstaking, boring details, it comes back to, you know, over $20 billion nationally, but that's just the gross clinical costs. As you said, that would be a situation in which we'd had no co-payment, no premiums, nothing of that. But then we also have to factor in, there's administrative costs, which also get added in, that adds that up a bit. And then there's also the fact that this universal program would actually be replacing existing programs. And if it's universal, meaning everybody's covered, it replaces everybody that's on a private insurance plan, which includes public sector employees. And public sector employees, full-time ones across all orders of government in Canada, more often get dental benefits, but they're brokered through a private brokerage. And that's money that we pay for through our taxes. Our estimates total that up to about $6 billion in 2019. That's just for public sector workers. So you'd be replacing that. You'd be replacing the $1 billion that we spent in 2019 on those public plans. So just think about that for a sec. You know, $1 billion is spent on, as we said, people who are lower socioeconomic status, who need to have the higher burden of oral health disease. We only spend about $1 billion. But to cover the whole system, we need to ramp this up to, you know, closer to $20 billion clinically, or in terms of clinical costs. So you're right, there would be expected big increase in the total number of Canadians using dentistry, and perhaps the frequency in a given year by which they utilize dentistry. But as we've said before, this has benefits that are preventative on the rest of the health system as well. The rest of my work comes into looking at alternatives. And the alternative that I looked at was, what if you just covered this for people who just don't have private insurance? So filling that gap. Because as I said at the beginning of this, I don't know if I put numbers to it, it's about 33% of Canadians don't have insurance for dental care, any insurance, public or private. So that's a pretty significant gap. How much would it cost to fill that? And obviously, it's closer to about $14 billion. So obviously, the gross clinical cost is less because you're covering less people. Now, where it gets a little interesting is when we talk about this idea of copayment and premiums. I want to emphasize from an economist perspective, I know that in the healthcare system, we don't do copayment. Less and less provinces are doing premiums. But I want to emphasize that it is kind of important to have these measures built in because you don't want to necessarily have completely frivolous use of public covered dental services. You want people to make sure that they are still brushing their teeth, still taking their oral health care seriously. And from a behavioral economics perspective, we know that adding in even just marginal copayments does change behavior. And studies do show it does change behavior towards good oral health practices, good overall health practices, be preventative. There's a theory, and this is a theory, it's unpublished. I heard this from an econ prof once who suggested that those, you know, fail videos on YouTube where people are like breaking their necks off Ikes and everything, that those tend to occur more often in countries that have robust public health care systems. Because the financial burden is on the public system, it's not on them. But if you add copayment, people start to make different choices. That's just a theory. I don't really subscribe to it that religiously. But copayment and premiums, I do feel are very important. But I think that they're important as long as they're tiered to your ability to pay them. So in my paper, we tiered them based on your income and exempted a lot of lower income individuals, like below a household income of $40,000 to $20,000, that kind of thing, and below. So really, you would be having higher income people paying in the line share of direct out-of-pocket into these programs. In that sense, it transfers financial risk from low-risk individuals to higher-risk individuals. In that sense, higher-income people subsidize lower people more directly. And that's very important to have. And so what we did is we created a structure of copayments and premiums, and we applied them to both programs. And here's what we found. When they're applied to both programs, the universal dental care program at the net costs less than the net cost of just providing dental insurance to those without insurance. And the main driver behind this is because under that latter program, public employees are no longer eligible to be on it because they have dental insurance through a private provider. And most of the people in that insurance pool you're covering are poorer individuals who are exempt from copayment or pay less of a proportion. So putting everyone in the same basket is, you know, of payment, that is probably the most efficient way that we could go forward with this, just holding those two things equal. Now, in terms of actually rolling it out, the option of just providing insurance to those who don't have it is probably the easiest way to go forward, because you're not necessarily stepping on toes of private industry, but you still need to make sure that you're, as I said before, compensating dentists fairly so they don't just, again, choose not to take people in the public programs. To answer the other part of your question, or the other part of the equation, how do we pay for it? Is a, you know, because there's still a net cost, $6 billion is the net cost of national universal dental care. How do we pay for that? Really quickly, I'd like to see us raise tax revenue potentially that could help deter unhealthy behavior, such as the sin taxes on sugary sweetened beverages. I can go into more detail on that later, but we know that high consumption of sugary beverages causes oral health disease or is linked to it. So taxing that away may be a way to contain costs in universal dental care as well as pay for them using the tax revenue.
I think to add something to what you're saying there, Tom, that I think is really important to stress when we're talking about paying for universal dental care, is that we can actually shift the burden of costs onto the wealthy, because you can structure taxes in such a way that say the average person now is paying $600-$700 per person per year for dental care through their private insurance and out-of-pocket payments. When you struggle the tax system in such a way, you can structure it so that average, you know, working class people might only be paying $300, $400, whereas somebody who makes a couple million dollars a year is going to be paying a lot more.
I really appreciate you bringing that up, Brandon, because from my perspective on copays and premiums, which ultimately I do disagree with Tom's perspective here, is that taxation is a much better way to make sure that the wealthy are subsidizing a public service like universal dental care for the rest of us rather than a tiered copay system. And the reason I do say that is because ultimately, at the end of the day, I would rather have a small minority of take advantage of universal dental care through frivolous uses, then have people not be able to access dental care because of the financial burden that it places on them, or even the administrative difficulties that something like a copay or a premium system places onto people. Not to mention that I think a copay or a premium system also adds kind of an administrative burden to any kind of universal system, and that removing that burden of clerical work and of administration not only makes the program easier to administer, but it also makes it easier to defend politically, both when you are implementing it and, like with universal Medicare, when you are defending it from the decades of attacks that have happened to it across the country.
Sorry, just to rebut really quickly. I mean, I like this discussion. I love the points you raise. And again, you know, we're not, you know, please disagree with anything I say or anything, like, because honestly, the only way that we get good public policy is if we have debate, frankly. Just to your point about, you know, I'm fine with a small share of the population having frivolous use. When you think about it, the small share that I'm referring to is the lowest on the, you know, the income structure. They're exempt from it. So the behavioral effects of co-payments, premiums, that doesn't touch those individuals. So an argument I've had with a few other health economists is that, well, no, the poor will be just going off and getting a bunch of denture work and orthodontic work. And my exact response to that was similar to yours, which was, yes, good, because they're the ones that have the highest burden of it. It's not actually frivolous, because when you're lower income and lower socioeconomic status, you just have a higher risk for dental issues. We have, like we said, that sort of cycle of poverty of, you know, if you don't have good teeth, you're not going to get a job. So I would like to see those individuals being able to take advantage of orthodontic work and things like that. It's when you get further up the chain, if you have the household ability to pay directly, then I think you're going to get a lot of arguments from both economists, but also just even more people maybe on the libertarian side of the spectrum that would say you should be able to do it yourself, you know. If you have the means to pay, do it. I strictly argue it from an economics perspective of just you're trying to transfer financial risk between pools. And you're right, the tax system does do this, but salience matters. And what I mean by that is it's kind of like when you look at your bill at a restaurant and you see the tax listed out at the bottom, or you see it on the menu, it changes how you think as a consumer. And I know that sounds a little weird because I'm calling you consumers, not patients. But from an econ perspective, that's what they are. It does cause you to think about this. And the way we tier it in the paper is we really emphasize, you know, low levels of copayment on preventative measures and you know, routine checkups, so that, that way people are going to the dentist more often. And that way, too, it undercuts the private plans because they don't tier based on your income, which is not fair. So that's just my rebut there.
I think something to add to that, Tom, as well, is that I think in theory that adding the tiered copayment system can have benefits. One concern I have politically, though, is that once you open the door for those out-of-pocket payments, it's much easier for, say, a conservative government down the road in time of austerity to make that copayment or that out-of-pocket payment apply to broader swaths of the population in order to save government spending.
And I take that point too. To be honest, there's a side of me that would say that might be necessary if that's the choice. We have to think about overall healthcare spending as it is right now. You know, in Alberta alone, income tax, just personal income tax, does not cover the cost of the healthcare system. So, and I know we have other tax revenue sources. As I'm saying earlier, we need to think about other new ones if we want to talk about expanding the healthcare system. But And also to a point that was brought up before about, you know, it's an administrative burden. I think that's a very fair point, because currently in Canada, we don't have an auto file tax system, you know, so how do we link the, and now I sound like I'm arguing with myself, but I'm full disclosure on it. Like, we don't have an auto file tax system. So how do we link your income from your last, you know, notice of assessment to your healthcare number? The data exists. It's possible. We know from other European countries that have very advanced e-government structures that it can be done. And the Trudeau Liberals have suggested in the last speech on the throne that they want to move to that. So when we talk about access to oral healthcare, that's a big piece of the puzzle we're missing. As I mentioned before, can't get on the existing programs unless you can prove your poor. Unless we fix that hurdle, then exactly as I've proposed in this paper about tiered co-payments and tiered premiums, it can't actually be administered effectively.
And I'm happy to argue for an autofile tax system as well. It's something I believe should exist because of the administrative burden that it places on poor and working class people. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I do think co-pays and premiums are antithetical to a vision of universal dental care. And I think one of the reasons that universal programs like our universal Medicare system are so strong is because they create a much larger constituency than a program that is tiered in any way. One of the main political issues I foresee with a program that includes co-pays and premiums is that it could be structured in such a way that people will begin to think of public dental care as something that is for poor people or that is for certain segments of the population rather than something that is universally held and universally defended. So I think when you have a program that's universal, you create a larger political constituency that can be mobilized to defend it in the future. And I think that's very important for not only defending the program itself, but also for how building up a stronger welfare state fundamentally restructures our society in a way that I believe is positive.
Absolutely. I think that's more of an argument I would agree with when you're thinking of the choice between those two models I put forward, the two ideas of, you know, universal dental care or dental care just for the people who don't have insurance, because that's a lower pool. And as you said, there's less agency in the public, there's less buy-in from people. And you're right, then that's just for the poor. And that's why I tend to argue for the universal single basket, everyone in the same pool, because we do have the agency. I'm not aware of any studies or political science, you know, studies to suggest that, you know, being in one pool and having one person pay a premium while another person not necessarily takes away that agency from higher income people being involved in, you know, and keeping their buy-in to the system that they have. Because that certainly was not the case that we saw with MSP premiums in British Columbia, or even when we had health premiums here in Alberta. Public policy is hard because it always involves choices. And I think you raised some very interesting trade-offs that premiums and co-payments have that are maybe more political in nature than, say, economic. So, yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, Tom, I feel like that's something I very much appreciated reading your papers, was that I feel like very few academics make those bold stances and say we should switch towards a universal system. From my experience, many have been much more comfortable saying maybe we should tinker on the edge here or there, but making the jump towards having a universal system, I think, is a huge step in the right direction. Because when we have a system where someone can get paid $100 for doing a filling for one person and $50 for doing a filling for another person, we create a fast lane for the people who have that higher amount and a slow lane for the people who don't. And at its core, that universal dental care system is a huge step in the right direction to fix that and create a more equitable dental care system.
100%. And that we have a whole Supreme Court decision in BC that explained why we didn't want that in Medicare, that you could have a fast line for people who can pay for their, you know, day surgeries versus everybody else that can't.
One interesting thing that came up in Brandon while you were talking was salary-based dental therapists. And so I assume the calculations, Tom, that you're doing are like other sort of Medicare things, and they're done more by procedure rather than salaried. So I think it would be interesting to open up the question of, like, what would a salaried form of dental care, something along the lines of the UK's NHS, although the UK's NHS has co-pays for dental care, but like what a salary-based kind of dental care would look like. But then thinking more broadly about, you know, some of these things, one of the other things we see is that Alberta has a dental fee guide, which the Alberta Dental Association releases, which is supposed to act as a general non-binding guide on like the costs for services. And prices in Alberta tend to be higher than like, say, in BC, like 26 to 32% higher, for example. So what do you think explains the price differences that exist already? And then how do we go about dealing those things if we're going to make a kind of publicly funded system?
I think something to add to what you're saying is, I think it's very interesting to see how a private dental care system works. So Alberta's obviously had, you know, financial booms with the oil industry and people who make a lot of money, and dentists have chose, instead of using this as an opportunity to have a larger segment of the population accessing these services, they saw it as an opportunity to raise their fees. And this is something that you can do when you're in a private dental care system, because there's no tug of war really between dentists and the public trying to figure out what a reasonable fee is. There's just the tugging by the dentist, and they're tugging it in a higher direction. And we don't have that kind of collective force acting on behalf of the public, tugging in the other direction. And that's something that under a universal dental care system, we have the ability to move in the other direction. Like we can actually have the conversation, how much should a filling cost? And the program that we are proposing under the Coalition for Dental Care is a universal dental care system that follows three main principles. One of them is universal dental insurance, which, as we've discussed, that would result in most dental offices that operate under private practice would still operate, but they would function, they would be paid by the government rather than private insurance. But along with this, we would also create a publicly owned dental sector, which creates clinics in many poor and marginalized communities that's been neglected by the private practice fee-for-service model. So what we propose is that these publicly owned clinics be set up in, say, poor, rural, and Indigenous communities, but also in long-term care facilities, schools. I'm sure there's other areas as well that I can't think of off the top of my head. And this is where these salaried dental therapists should work. That public salaried approach is very effective, especially when you're delivering services to certain communities, because you could imagine if you're doing a filling, say, on a child with autism, it's going to take a lot more time and energy than doing a filling on a child who cooperates well, and it's going to take a lot less time for that child as well. So if you're working on a fee-for-service model, you're really disincentivizing people from working on, say, people with disabilities who it takes on average more time per procedure.
Yeah, I just want to jump in just to mention, like, the papers I wrote were kind of before this, I was aware of this proposal, so it's not costing out specifically Brandon's proposal, though I really like it. And I really like the idea of using mid-level providers, using more public space to deliver in rural, remote communities. So these might be additional costs, but they might also be offset based on using like mid-level providers. So they may not change the overall costing figures of universal insurance system by too much. The other area that I do research work in has been physician compensation in Alberta. And we've seen how, you know, we've been very locked into fee-for-service. And you're right, like my costing analysis was sort of on the assumption of fee-for-service. There is a line in the second paper I wrote near towards the end that's like, you know, suggested among other recommendations, pursue things like the capitation rates or salaries, because these tend to produce just better like allocation of dental resources and dental services and utilization overall in the system. And so we don't want to necessarily, if we're starting something, you know, from scratch, which is the title of one of the papers, we're starting a new universal dental care system. Let's try and get everything right. let's do the things that our current health system has really been floundering with, which is, for one thing, how we remunerate physicians, and really try and leverage that evidence that we know about how payment mechanisms in healthcare really affect overall care quality and care outcomes. Apply that to dentistry. So that's just my addition there.
I think something to add to what you're saying, Tom, as well, is that our decision with the Coalition for Dental Care to go with that joint kind of private practice and public dental clinic model is to some extent a tactical decision based on what we feel we can hopefully achieve in our society. And what we see is dentists, by and large, want to work on the private practice fee-for-service model. And we see ourselves as needing to build the institutions, build the bridges within the dental community to educate people to really start to build the will where dentists are going to want to work in that sector. Because what we see a lot of dentists do is they pivot away from doing basic dental care because they have the option of doing luxury and cosmetic procedures. So instead of them setting up a clinic in, say, a rural or poor neighborhood that really needs dental care, they tend to set up in wealthy areas of cities where they can do very high revenue procedures that are very luxury and cosmetic rather than doing basic dental care. So we made the tactical decision that a universal dental plan as described, providing everyone with insurance, will on the one hand drive dentists into those poor neighborhoods and hopefully set up clinics, but also the public sector will help fill in the gaps that dentists aren't servicing. So those public clinics can go, say, to rural indigenous communities, long-term care facilities, places like that, in a more organized fashion.
100%. Because I think, and what Brandon's really alluding to is these other dimensions of access. When we talk about what is improving access to oral health care, that's a multidimensional thing. Like, we've talked about financial access a lot on this podcast so far. You know, who pays the bill, by how much? We've debated a little bit about, you know, the types of financing. And but we've also touched on this other aspect, which is physical access, finding a dentist near you, let alone finding a dentist who near you willing to take you on as a public patient. And then there's also the bureaucratic access that we talked about before. If it's just, you know, programs for the poor, how do you prove you're poor? How do you prove you're eligible? So all these put together are really key considerations that government's really going to have to think long and hard about.
Brandon and Thomas, thank you so much for coming on our podcast and giving us a comprehensive overview of some of your work and advocacy around dental care in Canada. If people are interested in finding out more about you or the work you do, where should they go?
They can find us at Coalition for Dental Care on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Please message us if you're interested and want to get involved, or just, you know, follow us to see more events and information on the subject.
Yeah, and you can head over to the School of Public Policy website, policyschool.ca. You can find those publications that I worked on there. As well, you can follow me on Twitter at Tom Lang YYC.
Amazing. Yeah, once again, thanks so much for joining us. I think this episode turned out great.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for the debate too. I really liked it.
That was my favorite. Makes no difference where
I go. Like today's episode, you should check out the Harbinger Media Network, featuring shows like 49th Parallel, where ideological influencer and Twitter titan Rob Rousseau explores the hellish nightmare world of modern reality together. Find out more about the Harbinger Media Network and the entire cross-country lineup of podcasts at Harbinger Media Network.
Then you started your rings. The air was fragrant and thick with our silence. I held my breath as something deep inside pinched. I touched the bump on your wrist you were born with. Watching you trying to push away. It hurts when you see it coming. You're too proud to tell me that you can. Watching you trying to push away. It hurts when you see it coming. Never use your words to show you care. I think you know it. Too cool to show it. Make yourself good. You're too good to be true. I think you know it. Too cool to show it. Make yourself good. You're too good to be true. Through the way that I sit and start to pick at the rips in my Nikes. You quote Tom York and lean in for a quick kiss, but still you just won't admit that you like me. Watching you lower both your eyes, it hurts when you know it's over. Still too stubborn to show that you can. Watching you lower both your eyes, it
If you made a compensation claim for abuse at an Indian residential school, the records of your claim are secure. They will be destroyed in September 2027 unless you choose to keep them or share them. To learn more, call toll-free 1-877-635-2648 or go to myrecordsmychoice.ca.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to Too Good by Arlo Parks. That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of CKUT's Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, @AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who made educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you'd like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche @AvalancheCKUT.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news@CKUT.ca. Stay tuned for Hearsay, that's up next.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Hey, you. Come over here and listen.
Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Yeah. Yeah. Like that. Like that. I would love your cock to be inside me. Oh, fuck. Oh, God. I'm really gonna come. Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Can you see how wet I am? Oh, fuck. Yeah. Oh, fuck.
It's time for Audio Smith.
A queer, feminist, trans positive radio show about fucking in all its forms. Mm.
four, five fingers.
Let's not beat around the bush. This show contains explicit sexual content.
So turn the volume all the way up.
Oh, that was so hot. I'm gonna pee for you now. Are you ready? Yeah, you wanna watch me pee? Oh yeah, I'm gonna pee, yeah.